For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit truegreen.com, TRUGREEN.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Hello, I'm Peter King, and welcome to the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, where I take you inside the minds of the biggest influencers in the NFL. This week, my guests are Miami Dolphins coach Adam Gase and the coach of Stanford, David Shaw. I asked Gase, who's only 38 years old, about all of his mentors in this business, including current Alabama coach Nick Saban.
There was a regimen every day. You just knew exactly what to expect. You knew what was coming, and it was a grind. I mean, it was tough. It wasn't easy, but there was a purpose behind everything, and he had a great process, and I've gravitated towards that. Everything is just so ingrained in my DNA now.
I asked David Shaw, why is football so different at the college level from the pro level? Because he's coached in both places.
College football and the NFL are two different sports. What it takes to be successful in college is not what it takes to be successful in the NFL. You're in college, the essential for being a good college football coach is to never, ever forget that someone just dropped their most important possession in my lap. No matter what I do, no matter what I say, whether we win, whether we lose, whether I yell at a young man or put my arm around him, I can't ever, ever forget that that's somebody else's baby, and they gave him to me.
Coming up next, my conversation with Adam Gase. Capital One knows you've got questions about your credit. You may be asking, who's really in charge of my credit score? How does my credit score actually work? That's why Capital One created the CreditWise app, so you can check your credit score anytime you want, right on the app. And it's free to everyone, Capital One customer or not. I mean, what a great deal. In fact, millions of CreditWise users have improved their score by 20 points or more, so download the app for free today. Availability depends on presence of credit history from TransUnion. CreditWise is offered by Capital One Bank, N.A. Back on the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, I am here in Jersey City, New Jersey today with Adam Gase, the rookie head coach, not going to be a rookie for very much longer, though, of the Miami Dolphins. But as we so often do on the podcast, we talk about things that aren't necessarily week-to-week things. I really hope that by the end of this, you get to know Adam Gase a little bit. But Adam, thanks so much for joining me.
No problem.
So what I'm interested in is, you know, you have prepared for this moment, this year, for a long time. You've been a student under so many interesting and good coaches. And I guess I would start off by saying, what for you has been the biggest difference in everyday life, even from being a coordinator position coach to now being a head coach?
I think time, trying to manage your time, dealing with the media every day, even though you don't think it's too much, it's 15, 20 minute spurts. It's more time taken away from what you're used to doing as a coordinator. And it builds up throughout the week. And then when you have to deal with little tiny things within the building of organization stuff, where it's 15 minutes here, 20 minutes here, and then a lot of your day gets ate up by that, and now all of a sudden you're trying to figure out how do you still game plan, how do you make sure you watch all the film, how do you make sure that you're communicating with your coordinators to where everybody's on the same page and your staff, and then deal with your players.
How difficult has it been to sort of set aside enough time for football and for teaching football?
That's been the most difficult thing, to make sure that we're doing staying with the details of what we've done in the past when I was at least a coordinator, some of these guys I've worked with before, And that's been the hardest thing to make sure that we manage correctly. There's been some times where we've mismanaged some time earlier in the season. It was a learning curve for a lot of us, trying to deal with the fact that I was calling plays on offense and our coaches trying to make sure that they knew what I wanted, and I couldn't really spend all the time that I needed to. And then as the season went on, we really got in a better groove. Things were much more organized as far as what we were trying to do. And it was nice to have a guy like Vance Joseph on the other side of the ball who handled so many things, and I was able to get in and out with very quickly, and he did a good job of managing that side of the ball.
I thought what was really interesting, I brought this up, we had our staff holiday party this week, and Andy Benoit, who writes about football for us and writes about sort of the inner game and a lot of tape study, I remember after 2 weeks, you guys were 0-2, and Andy wrote something that he said, they're a lot better than 0-2. They've played Seattle and they've played New England. Anybody who plays Seattle and New England is going to be lucky to be 1-1. And I brought it up to him this week and I said, man, you're a seer. They're 8-3 since then. And he goes, you know, you could just tell. You could just really tell. But I am curious. You played so well at Seattle in the first week of the season, and it really looked like 2-3 minutes to go, you're going to win that game. And you lost. You lost in a crushing way. And you had to get back on the plane. You got to fly 6 hours back across the United States. And you've got to somehow, I assume, watch the tape on the plane and say, my God, we had that game. We should have won that game. Your first game as an NFL coach, what did you feel like getting back on that plane for that long flight?
That was a tough one to swallow, not only for myself, but our players. They really sold out, and a lot went into that game, just like every other
team. For the offseason. The whole offseason you're working on that game.
Absolutely, and plus there's always – I always say that they have a little piece of my soul a little bit too, because, you know, losing them in the Super Bowl, every time I get a chance to go against those guys, you just want to make sure you give them everything you have. And
just to let everybody know, you were on the Denver staff, obviously, right, that lost 43-8 to the Seahawks in the Super Bowl. And, of course, that was a bitter loss for everybody associated with that franchise, with the Broncos.
Absolutely. And Maxwell always seems to remind me about it every once in a while. one side of that game
your
was
quarterback, Byron Maxwell. Yes.
And as we were watching the film, we saw so many missed opportunities. And there was a few things that happened in that game. It really hit me as we have a ways to go, because there were the smallest of details were missed that could have been game-changing plays that – some people may have not recognized. And that's where I really realized how much further we had to go before we got a lot better offensively. And on defense, we left a few plays out there that we had to make some strides there.
So you get back to South Florida. Are you a little depressed? Or are you fired up because you took the possible NFC champion, you gave them everything that they could have possibly wanted?
We corrected what we needed to correct. We really made a big emphasis of, we have to learn from this game. And then we knew what we had up next. And New England had just beaten Arizona, so we knew it was gonna be a challenge. It was gonna be their home opener. You know, Jimmy's playing quarterback for them, and they had just went into Arizona and beat them. So our guys.
So even though it was Garoppolo against Brady, you didn't think it was gonna be that much of a difference.
Anytime you play that coaching staff, no matter who's on the field, they're going to find a way to put – you're going to get their best shot, and you're going to get a dynamic scheme. You're going to get what's best for that week, just from my experience being with Josh. So sometimes when players are in and out of there, and it really hasn't mattered who's been throughout the entire 53-man roster, you're going to have a challenging day, especially when you play up there. So we knew we had to regroup. We had to refocus on that one game. We could not – think about what had happened in Seattle.
Curious, what's it like for a guy who is kind of a coaching lifer like you to stand on the field in Foxborough and just look 53 yards away on the other side is one of the greatest coaches of all time, is Bill Belichick. What's that like for you?
I wasn't thinking about it. I was so in the moment of trying to just make sure our guys were in good shape. We started out so rough, it was more of, okay, we got to make sure we're getting back, kind of getting our heads back together. I mean, we were down, I think we were down 21-0, 24-0 so fast that I had my own issues trying to get those guys, you know, rallied around and get us back going at halftime. But anytime that you're on, you play a team that has, especially, you know, Coach Belichick, you just know you have to bring your A game. You have to do everything you can to get your guys ready to go. You have to make sure that your guys are on it because that's the kind of game it's going to be.
When you were interviewing for this job and you're talking to Mike Tannenbaum or Mike Tannenbaum, Stephen Ross, the owner of the team, you're talking to them, how often, if at all, did the subject of your age come up? You're still young. You're a young man. You're 38 years old. And I've wondered, even though you've had a lot of great experiences in coaching, that's still young to be a head coach in the NFL.
That was not something that was really discussed. I think the only time that it was brought up, Mr. Ross made a comment to me that when he hired a lot of people in business, they were usually younger guys that he helped develop and bring up through the ranks, and that's what he liked being around. He liked being around, you know, young people that were energetic and had some fire to them, that were aggressive, and he just kind of describing really himself. I mean, that's how he is. If you're around him, you see a guy that's really into whatever he's doing, whether it's his business or with us with the Dolphins. He's so passionate about what he does, and kind of, I think that's what he was looking for, is, you know, somebody that was going to be the same way as him.
Here with Adam Gase on the MMQB podcast with Peter King. So, Adam, I ask a lot of people when I have them on the podcast how they got to where they are today. And especially with you, you've had so many interesting mentors in your life. You're only 38 years old, but some of the people, Nick Saban, you know, Joe Vitt, Mike Martz, you know, being around John Fox, Peyton Manning. I mean, I'm curious, if you were to pick out, I don't know, a few guys who you feel have been important to you and who really kind of indoctrinated you and got you really into this life, this game, and this coaching world, what would you say?
I'd have to start with Dean Pease, just for the fact that he gave me an opportunity coming out of high school, which is unheard of. And, you know, we just played them, and they smacked us around a little bit, which is kind of painful to go through. But just seeing him again and kind of looking back of that was how I got started, was him giving me an opportunity to create a self-scout off an Excel program. I had no idea what I was doing, but figured it out. And then working for Nick for 7 years and being at Michigan State and then going to LSU, just having that opportunity to be around
him. You were
the
only assistant he brought with you?
So I was a student assistant, and then when he went to LSU, I graduated and went down there as a graduate assistant.
What was it about Saban that you think is imprinted on your brain today?
I think the way that he handled – I always liked the way he handled players, but how organized he was, how everything was done so meticulously – as there was a regimen every day. You just knew exactly what to expect. You knew what was coming, and it was a grind. I mean, it was tough. It wasn't easy, but there was a purpose behind everything, and he had a great process, and I gravitated towards that. I liked that structure that he had, and I think that just made me go towards that as far as going to LSU instead of staying at Michigan State.
I once asked someone who worked for Nick Saban, said, what's it like working for Nick Saban? And I said, does he ever, like, have fun? He looks so incredibly serious. And he goes, well, you got a point there. He said, we always joke on the coaching staff that a big celebration for Nick is a 7 o'clock meeting the next morning after a night game. That's his celebration because more football. But, you know, what was he like, and what do you think rubbed off as a person on you about Nick?
I will say I've seen him have fun when we always had signing day that night. You would always see a big old smile where he knew that chapter had ended, and, you know, he'd always take the staff out, which was always a fun night for all of us just because we didn't have a lot of time to hang out as a staff, and that was the one time that the whole group would go and get a hangout and kind of get a talk, you know, BS a little bit, just hang out. I remember that. I remember that kind of ingrained in my brain as far as seeing him kind of enjoying being around the staff like that. But like I said, his process, the way that he handles everything is just so ingrained in my DNA now. It's just, I don't know if that'll ever change.
Where do you think you got your offensive path? Whose offense really appealed to you and you said, if I get a team, I want to run it this way?
Well, it started with March, just really the way he taught. Yeah. So the way he taught, and I really gravitated towards that. And getting to spend 3 years with him was unbelievable for me because I was so young and I was just soaking everything in. And so spending all that time with him, seeing how he taught quarterbacks, see how he taught wide receivers, and how he communicated with the offense was huge for me. It really made me take a huge jump in my career as far as my mental capacity and then being able to present things in front of the players. But I would say it really went to another level when we got Peyton in Denver in 2012. That's where it went to a different level.
See, you had a really interesting career in Denver because you start off and you got Tim Tebow. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, I mean, you know, even though – wasn't it Ben McDaniels was his position coach right away?
2010, yeah.
Yeah, 2010.
I was the wide receivers coach.
Right. But eventually, you know, those are two ends of the spectrum. You know, pretty much kind of an option quarterback, and then Peyton Manning, maybe the best drop-back quarterback in history. I mean, just – so – if you can, talk a little bit about what you take away from Peyton.
The detail of everything he ever did. I'd never been around somebody that was so into every little thing that was going around the entire building. It didn't matter what your job was. He wanted to know what you were doing, how you did it. He was so inquisitive about all those type of things. But then going to the football side, he always wanted answers. If you had a question, if you didn't have an answer for him, that was an issue. But he would ask the right questions, and he would demand so much for you as a coach to make sure that you were ready for it. When he asked the question, there was no wasted time. It was you had to know what was going on. And so as a coach, it made you better because you had to prepare. You had to be ready to go for your meeting with him because you knew something was going to come up. He was going to ask you a question, and you're going to have the answer for that question. And if you didn't, he wasn't going to let you forget about it. So it was just that challenge.
There was some
every
pressure,
week.
More pressure on you probably there than on some of your other previous jobs because you knew that in some there weren't many places ever where the quarterback might know more than the coach.
That it's so true. In the situation I was going from coaching option 2011. I just spent the entire summer 2012 really reinventing what I knew as far as protections go because he was so detailed in how do we block this? What if this happens? What are we going to do if they give us this look? So I had to really study a lot over the summer and really get caught up into something that I wasn't particularly used to. And as we kind of grew together, there was a couple of things that we started doing that he had never done before, which he liked. He wanted to challenge himself and do something that he had never been a part of before. So we always try to find new things to really keep him involved and engaged and really try to explore how far we could take that offense.
So what do you take away from Peyton Manning, and how do you think it has helped you, for instance, with Ryan Tannehill here in Miami?
The one thing I took away was he challenged me as a play caller. For 2 years that we were able to do that, 2013, 2014, he always said, you have to see the game the way I do. And I'm going, I've never played quarterback before, and I'm standing on the sideline and you're actually playing. He's like, I got it, but you can do this. And he always would challenge me to where we were always trying to play off each other and see the defense the way he wanted me to see the defense the way he was seeing it. And that was something that was awesome for me because it really did put a lot of pressure on me to make sure I was on it within a game and to develop myself as a play caller. And what I've tried to do is give Ryan some of the things that I've learned over time with all these different people. And with Peyton, it's hard to duplicate anything that he's ever done because it's his was such over a long period of time, and he changed really how football was played. I know the Bills were doing no huddle, you know, with Jim Kelly and those guys, but he took it to a different level with, you know, changing one play from another, was so late on the clock and getting to the perfect play.
I'm curious one thing about Manning. So when you coached him, did he always have two plays that he could change, always, or just most of the time, that he could call either one at the line?
It would depend. A lot of times with the running game, we would have two plays. A lot of the times with the passing game, it would just be one. And then we'd always make sure we had answers to certain pressures that teams maybe, if whatever they leaned on a lot, we always would have really an answer sheet. On Tuesday, we'd talk about if they did this, this, or this, here's what we're going to. So we really, with him, it was great because he could always remember everything. A lot of quarterbacks, it's just a lot of information to digest and then react really fast, where he had so much experience and had done it for so long, he would see something and he could react to it. And it's a time thing. It's just experience and time that it takes.
The interesting thing, I think, and I learned this, the last day that the David Letterman ever had a show, Peyton went to the show and he was on it. And he was so excited. He was like a little kid. He got in touch with me and he said, "Hey, would you have any interest in maybe writing about this?" He said, "This is a big deal for me." I said, "Of course I would." So at that time, you know, I'm running the MMQB and we're doing a lot of first person stories. And I said, "Would you be interested in doing a first person thing?" So this is where I really learned about the hands-on Peyton Manning thing. He said, "Okay, listen, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'll do it, but I'm flying back right after I do this to Denver, and I'm going to be back that night, and I'm going to send you some notes. And then why don't you write it up, you know, in my words, and then I'll do some editing and we'll talk about it." So I hate to say this. It makes me sound like I'm prehistoric. I didn't know what voice notes was, okay? And for people who are listening to this, what do you mean, you old dinosaur? You don't know what voice notes are. But anyway, so he sends me these things that, in essence, are text messages, but they're little recordings of your voice. And he sent me these. He sent me about five or six of these, like, really long notes where it's, "Okay, look, I walked in, and here's what happened." And he's almost, like, dictating this story. And then there were 24 phone calls the next day, back and forth, over getting it precisely the way he wanted. So tell me what it was like in that way with Manning, like late at night or weird times or Friday, getting a voice note or whatever. Is that the way he did things?
I still have them all.
You do?
I've kept them all. I even told him I have them. I said, "Oh, I'm going to use them one day publicly." And that's kind of like my threat I keep over his head. But I would get the voice memos. And a lot of it was he knew that I had certain meetings I had to deal with, and that was the easy way for us to communicate. Instead of texting back and forth or emailing back and forth, he could do the voice memo. It was 8-15 minutes long, and then we could kind of get back together that morning because we were really trying to keep up with his rest, as him not staying up all through the night doing right. these type of things. We wanted him to get recovered and ready for the next day. But what you went through was every week. And that's what it was. It was phone calls, texts, voice memos, emails, sitting down for breakfast, talking through the game plan. It was all the way up till he took the field. And that was our process, which it was good. It was just two psychopaths really just going at it and trying to make sure that we were completely ready for that game. And then it continued through the game. We were constantly talking during the game and trying to figure out what was the best thing for us to do that series.
Thought ever occur to you that, holy cow, I'm coaching Peyton Manning?
It didn't hit me until after I left. When I left and when I was away from him and watching him the next season, that was probably really when it hit me of, I wish I would have enjoyed it a little more than what I did, because we were so in the moment. We both kind of thought the same thing. In 2013, I don't think we enjoyed it as much as we should have. It was just, it didn't end the way we wanted to. And we were so focused on getting there and winning the Super Bowl. I never knew when it was going to be over with. I never knew because I never asked him that question. So every year that we would go, when we hit 2013, we lost the Super Bowl, in my head I'm going, I hope that's not it. I hope he's not going to retire now. Because I just didn't know. And just all I wanted to do was be part of the reason that he was able to go out with the Super Bowl. That was really, you know, my main goal.
Finishing up with Adam Gase. Adam, one more for you. The Miami Dolphins, obviously, storied franchise, and have been looking to get back to the sort of Shula Marino level for years. And I wonder, what sort of pressure is that on you? You always knew that you wanted to be a head coach in the NFL, and I'm not saying you could have had your pick, but whatever. You're here in Miami, and how much pressure is there on you knowing that there are two such huge shadows with this franchise? There's a perfect season in Shula and Marino. What is that like for you to deal with? Is it good? Is it bad? What is it?
I've enjoyed being around that culture of the fact that I am with a franchise that has great history And we've embraced all our alumni that are down there. We have access to so many great players down there. And being able to meet Coach Shula and then seeing him at it. So I think I've seen him every home game except once. One time maybe. I'm not sure if he went to that game or if I for some reason I didn't see him. But just being able to see him for 5 minutes and talking to him, that's so valuable for me because he always gives me something before that game, and a lot of times it's run the ball. So I know that's what he wants to see. But, you know, Dan being around the building is big because he goes down with the quarterbacks, and he sits in there, and he'll always give some kind of nugget that's great for our quarterbacks. And we've embraced it. We don't look at it as pressure that we need to do anything, you know, out of the ordinary. We know we have a process that we're sticking with. We know exactly what our goals are as a team, and we try to use those guys to our advantage as – we bring them in and we accept that alumni, you guys can help us. You guys can help us make, you can make us better. And I think a lot of our guys like seeing some of those guys coming around and feeling those guys that were winners in the past. And because I feel like our guys are heading in that direction as far as they're doing things right. They're trying to give themselves the best chance possible to win on Sunday. And the more times those guys come around, the more helpful it is for us.
Adam, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast. Best of luck to you.
I appreciate it.
This is the MMQB Podcast. QB Podcast.
On the campus of Stanford University in California, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King. I'm here with one of the most interesting guys I've had a chance to meet in the football business, David Shaw, the coach at Stanford. David, thanks a lot for joining me on the podcast.
Glad to be here.
Okay. So we're sitting here in your office in the football building at Stanford, and right above us, there's two jerseys on the wall. Okay, they're Seattle Seahawks jerseys. One is from Doug Baldwin, and one is from Richard Sherman. Now, if it's okay, I want to just read just one little bit of what Doug Baldwin wrote to you. Can I do that?
Absolutely.
Okay. This is from Doug Baldwin, written on the numbers of his Seahawks jersey. Okay. To Coach David Shaw, and I won't read it all. It's very long. You took me under your wing, and you helped guide me and mold me into not only the football player, but the man I am today. I will never forget our talks and the times you showed me that you cared. You are and were always a role model for me to look up to. And for everything, I just want to say thank you. Love you, Coach. Go Cardinal. Go Hawks. And Richard Sherman is really a very similar message here on your wall. So I wondered, how did those jerseys come to be here? And what's your relationship like with those two guys?
For those are reminders of a few things. Secondarily, I would say how great it is to be in college football. Because you spend so much time with these young men in these formative years, going from kind of teenagery to young adulthood. And you're with them during the most intense moments, most likely, of their lives. Girlfriend issues, finals, midterms, playing at USC on the road, bowl games, conference championship games, all those things. These things are big, huge moments in their lives. And you get to see, you get to peer inside the hood. And as you know, I've coached in the NFL, and you know those are more finished products typically than as these guys are growing up. You get them from 17 to 21 or 22, something like that. So that's the first thing is just you know keeping them up there. It's just such a great part to be a part of their lives in this time of their lives. Secondly, for those two individually, I went through a lot with those guys. You know, good times, bad times, tough times, and both of them have good father figures in their lives. But when they're at school, you know, as a head coach in particular, and position coaches sometimes, but for certain guys, the head coach ends up being even more of a father figure to where you got to tell them when they're right and tell them when they're wrong and sit and hold their hand and put your arm around them when they need you and scold them and push them when they need that. And I was there for those two guys during really tough times in their lives, and I didn't always make it easy for them. Sometimes I allowed it to be hard on him. I let things weigh
imagine,
on him.
I can imagine just about Doug Baldwin, who's really an intense human being. From Pensacola, Florida, coming out to the West Coast, probably far away from home for the first time in his life. I can imagine what somebody who's 18 years old, how tough it must be both for him and for those who have to handle him.
Oh, no question. And anybody who's ever seen Doug knows he's got a big chip on both shoulders. That's just how he was born. That's how he came out of the womb. That's just how part of who he is. And coming here at not highly recruited, and actually coming here, honestly, with both shoulders being surgically repaired. So here's a young guy, relatively undersized, under-recruited, coming across campus, couldn't participate in the first part of training camp his freshman year because he's got bad shoulders, but he can't wait to prove himself. You know, he can't wait. He can't wait to compete. He can't wait to fight. He can't wait to get his meat hooks into college football. So we went through a lot. Some of it was very loud between the two of us. But one thing I never let him doubt was how much I cared about him and how much I wanted him to be successful.
I can only imagine that Richard Sherman, who some of the sort of mental jousting that I've done with him, you know, since he's been in the NFL and gotten to be a great player. Like, when people say, hey, what's Richard Sherman like? I said, well, he's smarter than everybody else. I mean, and I don't mean that, and I'm not exaggerating. You know, he's just really a smart guy, and he knows how you're thinking and all that. Was it hard to read Richard Sherman when he was here?
It wasn't hard to read Richard. Richard was the easiest guy in the world to read. It was realizing that there were, as I like to say, there's two Richard Shermans. There's the Stanford Richard Sherman, which is brilliant, not just smart. He's brilliant, thoughtful, intelligent, intellectual, conversational, on a variety of topics. And then there's the Compton Richard Sherman that is ready, willing, and able to fight anybody on any battlefield at any time.
The L.A. Richard Sherman.
There's no question. And he is a perfect example of when, you know, the world's foremost intellectual university meets Compton, California. And they're embodied in one person. And at different times, as I tease him sometimes, so different times we get different ones. And, you know, the Compton Richard Sherman is the guy that we see on Sundays on the battlefield, ready to battle against anybody, the best in the world. And the Stanford Richard Sherman, as I tease him, that's the guy that's supposed to give the interviews and talk to the Peter Kings of the world.
But how about talking to the Aaron Andrewses of the world after the NFC Championship game?
You know, and that was a seminal moment, I think, for Richard and for a lot of people, and ask Aaron Andrews about it. I mean, she loved it. She loved that part of it because
she loved the real.
As she told me, we talked about it. She said, I always get head coaches and quarterbacks after the game, right? And all you guys say the same thing. Well, we tried really hard today. Thanks to the other team, blah, blah, blah. And she said, for the first time ever, we got the raw emotion of what it takes to be the best corner in the league, playing in the biggest game of his career and coming through and making the play. You got to see that raw, intense, brash, slightly arrogant, confident defensive back. And at that moment, that was that guy. And what I love about it was a few hours later, on the podium, putting his suit on, he said the exact same thing that he said to Aaron. He just said it calmer and quieter. And nobody aired it. So it
but you
was
know what
just
I've always
delivery.
Thought, David? I've always thought that I really wish there was no cooling off period in the NFL. I really wish that we could get players right after the game because that Richard Sherman thing would happen 5 times a year.
And that's what you least. Understand that most yeah. people don't understand. And I think I did more radio shows after that than Richard did because people wanted to know, who is this guy and who does he think he is? And my best way to explain that was I said, you got a glimpse of what it takes to come out of Compton, California without a lot of money, be a salutatorian, be a great student athlete, go to Stanford University, be a draft pick, and be the best, what it takes to go from there to being the best corner in the league. It takes a lot of drive. It takes a lot of confidence. It takes a willingness to battle anybody, anywhere. And because of that, not having that cooling off period, you got to see what it takes to be great. And I mean, 5 seconds after a game, if you want to talk to Deion Sanders or Jerry Rice or anybody before that cooling off period, that's what you're going to get. That's a battlefield. That's a place where I better be all in, and I better believe I can beat anybody in the world. That's what it takes to be great. And then the cooling off period, and you get the sanitized version, which I think is great also. But I think everybody in the league that's great at what they do, that's how they feel.
David, just one more thing about these two guys. It's interesting. Richard Sherman, fifth round pick. Doug Baldwin, undrafted. Doug Baldwin, to me, has worked his way, has earned his way into being a top 10 NFL wide receiver, in my opinion. Richard Sherman, top 5 NFL corner. So how did that happen? Is it simply a coincidence that both those guys were here? Was there something here that you think helped them get to where they are today?
I would say yes, and I can't go further without mentioning Jim Harbaugh, who played a role in, and Richard was already here, but played a role in recruiting Doug and played a role in the environment that was put around them, and that was an ultra-competitive environment. I can also say that, you know, those two didn't have the greatest relationship with Jim at different times. It's well documented. It's no breaking news here.
Yeah.
But that in competitive environment was great for them because these are ultimate competitors. These are guys that don't back down. Those guys don't back down from challenges. They don't back down, obviously, from their head coach. They don't back down when they're faced with obstacles that are in the way of what they want to accomplish. Now, on a greater scale, Stanford University in general is the home of competitiveness, intellectual competitiveness. So that's why for those two guys, this place merged those two worlds, athletic, physical, intense competition on the football field, and intellectual challenges and competitiveness in the academic world. And those two guys are great examples of that. And you've seen that continue on in their NFL careers to where, you know, they're two of the best guys in the world to interview because they're not quote-unquote dumb jocks. These are brilliant young men that are pointed and directed in their lives and know what they want on the football field and know what they want off the football field. So, and not just what you said, but I think they're also great ambassadors for what Stanford University is about.
Before a training camp practice this year in Anderson, Indiana, I went up to Andrew Luck, and I was asking a bunch of players around the league the same 8 or 10 questions, and one of the questions is, what's your favorite TV show? And Andrew Luck said, The Man in the High Castle. And I said, what the heck is that? You know, but again, Andrew Luck, and as I sit here and talk to you in your office, right over your head is a picture of Andrew Luck being drafted. So I remember reading a lot. I think Pete Thamel wrote this then in the New York Times. He's now at SI. But he talked about how Andrew Luck, one of the reasons why he stayed was he loved just being a person. He loved riding a bike around campus that had a crappy seat on it. He loved just living in a dumpy apartment with his friends. And he realized that, look, one day I'm going to be making $1 jillion, but it's not going to be any more fun or rewarding than living in this dumpy apartment, riding a crappy bike around campus, and sitting next to people in class who are going to invent things one day that are going to help the human race. So I'm not trying to do a commercial for Stanford right now.
You're doing a pretty good job of it, though.
Well, but I would just ask you this question. I really think a lot of times when I see guys in the NFL who are really smart, I wonder if they were able to have the kind of experience that Andrew Luck had, or even like a Jared Goff at Cal, or Cameron Brate, the tight end for Tampa at Harvard. And I'm not saying that you have to go to one of those schools to have a real intelligent, maybe the Honors College at Michigan, I don't know. But I'm saying that I think part of what happens to you in college has to be you experience something different than you normally would experience just by going somewhere to develop as a football player.
And honestly, that's what's been missing and kind of gotten worse in college football a lot of places over the last 15 years because college football is so big, because there's so much money around it, and now it's the playoff and recruiting is out of control and all those things, that what gets missed is kind of, we talked earlier, that the formative years of college that we all grow into, grow through, good things, bad things, in the dorms, all those things that happen to you, there's a feeling in a lot of places to pull those guys out of that, make them into something else, these creatures that we get to go watch on game day. And we forget that they're between 17 to 22 years old. They're still kids. And I think being a college kid, not a small kid, but being a college kid, there's a lot of growth that happens there. And some of those need to be intellectual growths. And the fact that some of these guys don't take, I'll just say it, don't take real majors other places. They're just trying to get through school so they can go be superstars in the NFL. You miss something. And when you talk to a guy like Andrew Luck, you see that he didn't miss that here. He enjoyed that. He also kind of had a glimpse of the future. He knew what it was going to be like. He's been around Peyton Manning. He's been around a bunch of different guys. He knows what the gilded cage looks like for an NFL quarterback. Every city he goes to in America, he's mobbed, right? He knew that was coming. He knew it for probably since he was in high school. He knew what his life was going to be. And here at Stanford, it got to slow down a little bit. He got to be one of the guys. Yes, he was already famous. Yes, everybody knew who he was on campus. He'd ride his bike across campus and didn't get mobbed. They would just say, "Hey, Andrew." And he got to keep going. He got to stand in line, you know, with his jean shorts on and kind of hang out and be one of the guys. And the moment he stepped off that campus, he knew that was going to change. And it was hard for him to leave that and leave his friends. And for him, having one more year with his guys, one more last hurrah to do what he could, and had a phenomenal year until he stepped out into the real world and became what he is now.
What's the Stanford Andrew Luck story that you tell people if they say, "What was Andrew Luck like on this campus?"
Well, depending on the context, I have a few different stories. but one similar to yours, asking him what his favorite TV show was, I'll never forget the day that we're walking out to practice together and I asked him about NFL teams. And it was a very quick conversation, you know, and it was over. So we still have about 200 yards to walk before we get to the practice field. So I said, I know you love soccer. Tell me about soccer. He talked my ear off. The rest of the walk, all the way through, the best teams, the worst teams, the best players' signature moves, who can do from both feet, who you only have to worry about his right foot as a shooter, and all those things. And I just laughed and I said, "Stop. I get it. You love soccer. Stop." But for me, that's one of those things that some people see as kind of a negative because you're not this football player that lives and eats and breathes football. You got to have something else to make football special in your life. You got to have another hobby. You got to have something else you're interested in, somebody else you're interested in, something that doesn't have to do. So when you give to football, you give it your all, but you can also take a break mentally and have something else you're interested in. It was just great to see that. And Andrew is a very well-rounded person. He's got his book club. He's got all kinds of stuff going on. Now, when it's time for football, there's nothing else in the world. This guy is as focused and as good as anybody potentially who's ever played. This guy is amazing. But when he's away from football, he's a guy. He's a regular person. He wants to watch soccer. He wants to hang out with his friends. He wants to go to the restaurants. He wants to be a normal person. He doesn't strive to be, you know, Andrew Luck, the Colts quarterback, 24/7, you know, and love running around signing autographs and doing promos for that. That's not the Andrew Luck that he wants to be 24/7.
He was having a great year his first year in the NFL, and I went to Indianapolis to write about him. And normally, when I do something like that, I like to, if possible, and it's not always possible, spend a few minutes off campus, maybe go have a meal or whatever, and as friendly a way as he could say, his answer was absolutely not, because he did not want to set himself apart from anybody, especially as a rookie. I don't know that he'd still do it this day, but I think he really believes. One of the reasons he loves football is he loves the egalitarianism of it. He loves the fact that on a given Sunday, the 52nd guy on the roster could win or lose the game, and not the number one guy on the roster, the quarterback. And that, Bill Parcells always used to say, I always used to get a great kick out of that. I asked him one time about, man, you churn the roster. You know, you have like 8 roster moves this week, and I never heard of any of these guys. What are you doing? And he just said, picking up a guy who's going to either win or lose a game for us at some point this year. And I think Andrew Luck loves that about football. It's not a willy-nilly aspect of football. It's a really meaningful aspect of football because very often the last play in a game that might decide the game is made by a guy who is a free agent from West Alabama or something. Look at Malcolm Butler in the Super Bowl. Yep. Who heard of him on Friday before the Super Bowl when he intercepts Russell Wilson? That is what, to me, is so fascinating about football. And I know a guy like Andrew Luck, he sort of embraces that part of it.
Yeah, because nothing's certain. You walk into the game and you don't know what to expect. And he loves that. He loves the fact that if we work hard enough, we work smart enough, and I make enough good decisions, no matter who the other team is, we can win. And I might need to look up and see T.Y. is double teamed. And now I got to go to that third receiver, that guy that we just signed on Wednesday that just picked up the playbook that I just told him what to do the day right before the game. I might have to go to that guy to get that first down to seal the game. He loves that aspect of it. He loves the chess match of it. He loves the fact that there are moving parts and it's not easy. Now, this guy's brain's always working. So just the fact that he gets to go get on game day and challenge himself against the best in the world and have a chance to find a way to win, he loves it.
With David Shaw on the MMQB podcast with Peter King. So, David, a couple more things. I'm really curious about your future. And a couple of times I've asked you about it because obviously people in the NFL are interested in you as a possible head coach someday. And you've told me two things. You said, if I ever would go to the NFL, you're going to have to convince my wife that it's a better place than Palo Alto, you know, Stanford. And you've also said that you've got friends all over the NFL because you have obviously rubbed shoulders with a lot of coaches, scouts, head coaches in the NFL and throughout college football. And you think that you've got a better job now than all of them, you know. So do you think, could you ever see yourself one day being a head coach in the NFL?
One day down the road, I could see that. And I've never shied away from that. I never say never. But my daily job right now, in the heart of Silicon Valley, around these kids that are bright, motivated, competitive, athletic, you know, a lot of people don't know because we don't advertise as much as we probably should. I mean, in the last 6 years, I think we've won, we've got the fourth most wins in college football. And we're in the top four in wins. We're doing some great things here. We're putting out great athletes and great guys, not just into the NFL, but into all kinds of businesses. And walking in this building every single day, trying to find ways to win games and do great things with guys that are biology majors and mechanical engineering majors and biomechanical engineering majors, that's exciting to me. It's exciting to me to be at a place where what college football was supposed to be, we are still that, where I think so many have strayed. We are about the scholar athletes, you know. We are right at 99% again for graduation rate, trying to get to 100 and trying to do that every single year. We want to graduate our guys and we want to play great football. And being around all the guys that are on the same page, for me, it's as good as it gets.
David, I want to ask you about Christian McCaffrey. America has gotten to see, in the last 2 years, the guy who has led America in yardage for 2 years in a row. And yet this season, there seems to be this impression that he didn't have a very good year. And I wonder, when you look at his season, you know, last year he's a prime Heisman candidate, this year not even invited to the Heisman. So what kind of season did Christian McCaffrey have?
It's almost like a student who's an A-plus student, I mean, gets an A-plus in everything, and then gets an A. And you say, oh, you just got an A. That's what this season was like for me looking at Christian. Leading the nation in total yardage without getting a lot of punts and kickoff returns, which means it was almost all on offense. Last year, great kickoff return. He was the national returner of the year last year. Nobody kicked to him. They wouldn't kick to him. They wouldn't punt to him. He's got very few return yardage. And we had huge turnover in the offensive line, turnover at quarterback. So much of the offense was on his shoulders. And he still leads the conference in rushing. He still leads the nation in total yardage. Everyone in America knew exactly who he was, and we were going to force him the ball. It was going to happen every single game. And the guy still misses a game and a half and still leads the nation. So for me, it might have been an A compared to his A-plus from last year. It was like an A-plus in the hardest class given at Stanford. You know, it was like the hardest class given at Stanford. You're going to start the season as the number one player in college football, and everyone in America knows you're going to get the ball, and they're going to do everything they can to stop you, and he still leads the nation in total yards. That, to me, is almost a better season than the year before, with a five-year senior quarterback, with a great defense, and guys around three guys playing in the NFL on offense right now that we don't have that we had last year. So it's sad that that's the way that it is, but I think we're going to look back, and it's hard for me, and I love college football. I've been around college football my entire life. I can't sit here and say that he's not one of the top 10 players to ever play college football.
Wow.
That's what the numbers say. And you look at the competition that he faced versus the competition that Reggie Bush faced, or that O.J. Simpson faced, or that Marcus Allen faced, or that anybody else faced. It's on par with all that. In 2 years, this guy's done something. The yards that he's amassed at the Division I level in a major conference is better than anybody else has ever done. You can't say that he's not in the top 10.
Is that true? Over a two-year period, he has done that?
Well, you start off with the year that no one else has ever had before.
Right.
He blows away Barry Sanders' record. And, you know, who knows what would happen if he didn't miss a game and a half, and if anybody ever would have punted the ball to him or kicked the ball to him all year. But that two-year span, it's record-setting. It's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So that's why I look at it and feeling like the luckiest coach in America, that I got a chance to coach Andrew Luck and got a chance to coach Christian McCaffrey. I mean, it's something I'm very grateful just to be able to sit there and watch these guys that are virtuosos. They're phenomenal. They're phenoms at what they do. I couldn't be more proud to be associated with them.
David, I look at Christian McCaffrey and I wonder, there's nobody in the NFL right now. I mean, maybe Darren Sproles a little bit, but Darren Sproles only runs the ball a few times a game on average. But I can't envision an NFL coach saying, okay, we're going to let you return both kicks and punts. We're going to play you in the backfield, maybe a job share with another running back. We're going to split you out sometimes or put you in the slot. I mean, if you were to talk to an NFL coach, he says, where do you think this guy is best at? Does it make any sense for him to do all of this in the NFL?
It all depends on who the coach is and what their offense is and all of those things. I think what Christian has proven is that he's not one-dimensional. He's exceptional at everything. I would have loved not to have him back there kickoff return because of the shots that he takes. Then he leads the nation in kickoff returns for half the year last year. You know, you love to give him some rest at the punt return. Let somebody else return the punts. And he says, no, coach, I want to do it. So even after a long punt return, he's not one of those guys that looks to come to the sidelines. He goes right back in the huddle. It's a phenomenal condition. The closest NFL comparison for me is Shady McCoy. They're the same height. They're the same weight. The 40 time is going to be right about the same. You've got a guy that carries the ball over and over again. And maybe the difference between them is Christian can play receiver. So you've got a guy that can play running back, a down after down running back in the NFL, but he can also play the outside receiver. The guy can run every route in the book. And he can kick. If you don't want to kick off return, okay, great. But whatever team he goes to, he's going to beg to be the punt returner. He loves it. He loves having space. He loves getting the ball in his hands. He makes great decisions on when to fair catch it, when not to fair catch it.
What's the best run he's ever made that you've seen?
Oh, gosh, there have been so many. The punt return that didn't count this year against Kansas State was something I'd
block in the back.
Yeah, I had never seen before. First of all, for a guy I just told you makes great decisions, he caught the ball on the 4 yard line. Caught the punt on the 4 yard line, right? We're all sitting there saying, oh my God, don't do it. And he's surrounded by three guys when he catches the ball. He gets away from those three guys. Somebody else hits him. He gets away from that guy. Then he makes another guy miss, the next another guy miss, and takes it the distance. Three times during that play, the play should have been over. But it's a testament to his effort and his willingness to push himself to his limits, as well as his vision and athletic ability and stop and start and acceleration and all those things and ability to break tackles. Now, that's just one, but there have been so many over the last couple of years, and they're just that his career highlight film for 2 years is as good as you'll ever see.
Finishing up with David Shaw, the coach at Stanford. So I have two totally disparate questions that, I don't know, I could talk to you for another 3 hours, but I want to ask you two questions. One is about you. So it occurs to me in listening to you talk about you and sort of what you like about being here and about the NFL, that maybe you're a little bit like Andrew Luck. You really like what college football is when it's done right, and you like being here. You like the ideals of Stanford. And you know that one day, at least, you'll have a chance to go to the NFL if you choose. But maybe the NFL isn't the be-all, end-all, and should be the goal for everybody. Maybe college football should be the goal for some people. So how do you look at, you know, there are people who would say, oh, you got to go to the NFL if you have a chance. Come on, what's wrong with you? I mean, how do you look at that aspect of the impression that everybody has that if you're really good at something, then you should go to the highest level that there is?
The thing I try to stress to our guys who want to play in the NFL, I tell them that college football and the NFL are two different sports. NFL is not an extension of college. NFL is its own monster. It's its own entity. So for me, going from college to NFL is essentially changing jobs. You're changing jobs. You can't even do them the same way. And I think the people that have been successful on both understand that. What it takes to be successful in college is not what it takes to be successful in the NFL. Right, first, that's the biggest thing for me. You got to draw a big line.
What's the biggest difference, do you think?
Everything. I mean, absolutely everything. When you're in college, the essential for being a good college football coach, in my opinion, and maybe other people disagree with this, is to never, ever forget that someone just dropped their most important possession in my lap. I can't ever forget that. No matter what I do, no matter what I say, whether we win, whether we lose, whether I yell at a young man or put my arm around him, I can't ever, ever forget that that's somebody else's baby, and they gave him to me. That can't ever change. Now, in the NFL, when a guy walks in the door, he works for me. And he's got a job to do or I'm cutting him. And that's essentially, that's it. That's everything. You know, and the rest of it is how you do, blah, blah, blah. The essentials are both. They're completely different. So, you know, that 17-year-old kid that walks in the door, I'm there to take care of him, get the best out of him, teach him to push himself and teach him to expect a lot from himself in the classroom, on the football field, in the community. We're helping train young men to be successful in football and out of football. In the NFL, we're trying to win football games. Nothing else matters. Can you help me win football games, or can you not help me win football games? You know, and you can't be afraid to cut a talented player. You got to let him go. In college football, I don't want to cut anybody. They may play, they may not play, but before they leave this football team, we're going to help them grow. So that's why they're two completely different jobs to me.
Somebody's going to say to you one day, here's $8 million, come and coach my team. And you're going to have a tough decision to make. You really are.
Not at all.
No?
What's more money, especially when it's temporary? That's the thing with me that's so funny. Now, granted, I'm different because I grew up in this profession. My dad was a football coach. I watched it over and over again, happen over and over again. That first press conference for an NFL head coach who just got hired, as soon as that press conference starts, you start the clock for how long he's going to be there. It's just a fact of the business. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. That just is. It's 3 to 5 years. That's what you have. So that $8 million.
I tell you this, if you're lucky.
If you're lucky, if you're lucky nowadays, if you're lucky, so that it's not a permanent job. It's not an occupation. You are a temp. Every NFL head coach outside of Bill Belichick is a temp. So for me,
I told you that stat about how in the AFC East, the other three teams since Bill Belichick has been in New England have averaged 7.3 coaches in that 16-year period.
And to not understand that is folly. To be one of those guys that takes the money just because it's the money, it doesn't understand it. Now, if I get myself into that washing machine at some point, and that's what it is, it turns you up, and as soon as the timer goes off and you get out, then I'm doing it with my eyes wide open. For me right now, my daily life at Stanford University, I can't imagine there's a better job in America. And most guys, they'll say their job is the best job in America. I can't imagine there's a better job as I sit here with the Christian McCaffreys and Andrew Lux and Doug Baldwins and Richard Shermans of the world, who are engineers and biomechanical engineers and biology majors, going to be doctors, lawyers, on top of running power football and playing great defense and great special teams. What I'm around, and I don't like to talk about myself a lot, but I like to be surrounded by people who are great at what they do. Great students, great football players, great people. And that's what gets me going at Stanford.
My final question is just bizarre. I can't believe it. It's a really kind of a dumb question to end with, but I was going to ask you this coming here today. Why does offensive line play in the NFL stink? Why can't teams protect their quarterbacks anymore? And why are colleges churning out great players, including great quarterbacks? I think the young crop of quarterbacks in the NFL right now is, I don't care what anybody says, and I've heard a lot of people in my profession say that, oh my God, where are the great young quarterbacks? Everywhere. But the offensive line play has just been awful, other than places maybe like Oakland, Dallas, certainly, and but not many other places. So I throw that out. What do you think?
So you're going to make me answer this question.
Yes.
And I'm going to make a lot of people hate me.
Okay.
Right? Whoever, some people are going to listen to this and absolutely hate me, because I'm going to be that old school West Coast power offense guy that's going to say aspects of the spread offense have hurt the NFL, because it's not a one-to-one correlation. The skills don't come over. So you'll have a ton of offensive linemen that are very, very talented that are going to come into the NFL that have never, ever passed set. They've never passed set. They've never sat there with a quarterback that's 9 yards deep and kick, and punch to protect the quarterback, because there's so many run pass options. There's so many option plays. There's all these things where the guys don't have to. They can jump set a guy because the ball's coming out quick, or it's a really quick fly sweep play action deal and the ball's thrown, it's coming out very quick. In the NFL, what will never change about the NFL is the hashes are so tight. That's not the college football. You can't just flip the ball out there because there's not a lot of room out there. Terrell Suggs at 30 plus years old, he can still run sideline to sideline and catch that bubble screen you just threw. And in college, that bubble screen is going for 40. So it's a different world. It's a different
game. If it's on the right side of the field.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's a different game in that in the NFL, what once again will never change about the NFL, playing quarterback in the NFL is sitting in the pocket and throwing the ball through a door that's closing with dogs chasing you, right? That's the way I describe it. That's not college football. So you've got these offensive linemen that have never experienced that world, and now you're thrust in the NFL. Well, that's what the whole world is. It's third down, and it's red zone. That's the NFL. It's third down and red zone and quarterback play. And if you've never done it before, it's hard to learn how to do it on an NFL team. Because just as I said earlier, those GMs and those head coaches, they're sitting there saying, our jobs are on the line. We don't have time for you to grow up. We don't have time for you to learn how to protect the passer while you're here and while we're paying you. You either can do it or you can't do it. So the hard part is now all these really talented, athletic, and physical offensive linemen are getting thrust in the NFL with no experience in doing what it takes to be successful in the NFL. And now your $100 million quarterback is sitting back there with guys that are trying to protect him that have never, ever done what you're asking them to do. So like I said, there's going to be a bunch of spread guys around the country that are going to hear this and absolutely hate me because I'm bashing their offense.
All right.
But that's to me, that's the reality of what's going on.
I'll tell you this. I have found over the years, and I had somebody, a scout in the NFL, tell me, he goes, give me the second tackle at Wisconsin. Give me the second guard at Michigan State. And I'm happy because they've done what we do. And so then I start thinking a lot about, okay, then why don't you just draft offensive linemen either who do exactly that style of play or just scout in the Big Ten, you know, because you know that that's the style they're going to play.
Or Stanford.
Yeah, or Stanford. But I'm talking about in general. And I think when I look and see Russell Wilson getting the tar beat out of him, when I see some of the really good young quarterbacks just really getting beat up, I just say, man, there's got to be a better way, and there's got to be a better scouting way, and there's got to be a better developmental way. And I think one of the things is, I think you're right. I think that NFL teams should go away from really looking at tremendous athlete spread tackles, because it is going to take them a while to learn, and maybe they never will.
And that's the hard part. Some of them don't get it. And now you combine that with the other really big thing is, as the offensive line play is getting worse, the defensive line play is getting better.
Unbelievably.
Nobody's using tight ends anymore, so they're all becoming defensive ends. You've got these freak show defensive ends and guys that are pass rushers, and they're great at what they do, and that's one thing that does translate from the college to the NFL. So now, you look at the last 5 years of guys that have entered the NFL as pass rushers, explosive, physical, athletic guys, and combine that with the lowering and lessering of offensive line play, you've got a recipe for disaster if you've got a big-time quarterback that you need to sit back there and drop back and throw the ball. So you've got to find those couple of tackles that can pass it, and you can't care where they come from. They got to be able to do what it takes to be successful on Sundays.
David Shaw, thank you so much for joining the MMQB podcast with Peter King. I learned a lot.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Peter.
It's the MMQB podcast.
My thanks to Adam Gase and David Shaw for some thoughtful conversation. You know, a couple of thoughts now that we've had two interesting, smart, forward-thinking coaches on the podcast. We are, as I record this, starting to get into coach firing season. That also means coach hiring season. But what we forget so often in this business is the guys who get shown the door. And I want to talk about one of those people right now. His name is Gus Bradley. He was fired after the 14th game of the season with 2 weeks left to go for the Jacksonville Jaguars. And it was obvious that Gus Bradley was going to go. And in all the years I've been covering the NFL, 32 in all, there have not been very many coaches I've ever run into who were as humane, nice, gentle, gentlemanly, and also just considerate, not just of his players or the employees inside the Jacksonville organization, but of people he met everywhere. You know, I'd see Gus Bradley the last few years at league meetings, let's say, or other league functions, and you'd see him earnestly engaged in conversation with a waiter or a waitress at a restaurant, or with someone who just walks up to him and maybe asks him for an autograph at a league function. And over the years, even before he was a head coach, I got to know Gus Bradley well. And one of the things that I've always thought about him and so many people in the coaching business is that, you know, the business of football has gotten gargantuan to the point where most coaches and well-known players, it's very hard for them to go out and live a fairly normal life outside their little individual biodomes, you know, wherever they work. But I've always noticed that Gus Bradley just doesn't mind. You know, a 15-minute conversation with Gus Bradley would turn into an hour and 20 minutes. It always did. You get him on the phone, and he always wanted to talk. He had the philosophy that he could learn from anybody he ran into. I remember last summer being in his office in Jacksonville during training camp, and his bookshelves were lined with inspirational tomes. And I was asking him about it, and he said, you know, I don't really read them cover to cover. There's so many of them. But I get a little something out of almost every one to try to help inspire my team. And so this is a guy who is going to be on the unemployment line. He's going to be looking for work. And I know from knowing Bradley over the years that he's not angry. He doesn't hold a grudge. He knows that when you go 14-48, which is, for all men who've ever coached 60 games or more in NFL history, the worst record that a coach has ever had, he understands it's a bottom-line business. He's not mad at anybody. He knows he had a really good shot, and he just didn't win enough. And I just think sometimes we need to remember the people who you probably aren't going to hear from much anymore and what kind of people they are, rather than just hearing about the stars and the people who take their place. And I just know that I'm going to run into Gus Bradley, whatever he does. Maybe he'll be a defensive coordinator somewhere. He's going to have a big smile on his face. He's going to ask me how my life is. And I won't be any different from 50 people he meets on the same day that he says something to me, because that's just the kind of guy he is. I don't mean to be flaky, corny, or anything like that, but this is a good man who got let go. And I think we should remember that there are going to be a lot of good people and the families of good people who are going to be out there looking for work. And around this time of year, for every reaction, there's an opposite reaction. I just want you to remember the good people who either aren't going to be working anymore, who are going to be pounding the pavement, just like so many people are in America, looking for their next gig. Thanks to my guests, Adam Gase, the coach of the Miami Dolphins, and Stanford coach David Shaw. If you enjoyed these conversations, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes in the MMQB series, such as my conversations with John Elway, Larry Fitzgerald, and Luke Kuechly. You can find these on the MMQB.com or on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Listen to other podcasts in our series as well, with Albert Breer, Gary Gramling, and Andy Benoit. Thanks to the folks at Digital Media for their superb production work. Thanks, of course, to my sponsor, Capital One. Please support Capital One the way they support this podcast. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.